If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Hey, everybody, it's me, Sam Stye, managing editor of The Bulwark, and I'm pleased to welcome back Erin Banco, national security reporter for Reuters. Erin's been on once before. I've been meaning to have her back again. Erin's one of the best in the business. She didn't pay me to say that, but we did work together in a prior life when we were both at the Daily Beast. Erin, thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
I know. I toiled with not doing it again, but the last time went smoothly enough. So let's hope this one doesn't have any fireworks. We're going to be talking about what's going on in Iran. You've been reporting continuously about a number of different facets of the war. I think I want to do this chronologically, even though you're supposed to be forward-looking in these things. I think it's important to start with the sort of essential question, which is, why did we get into this war? What was the administration looking at specifically? We know their stated rationales, although they've kind of jumped all over the place. But from your reporting from the NatSec community, what was the real reason for getting into this war?
I mean, we have our own reporting. And as you stated, you know, the administration has its own talking points on why it's doing this. But also through the last couple of weeks, it's become apparent that while the talking points may be more aligned now publicly, there are actually people inside the administration who everybody has a little bit of a different answer. But truly, this story really goes back to Trump's reelection and his inauguration. Trump really enters this administration with a very public messaging that he does not want to get into a war with Iran. That's not something he wants to do. He wants to try to avoid it. Becomes very clear that he's going to try to go the diplomatic route with Iran. But at the same time, Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, is very resolved in the fact that in maybe late 2025 or early 2026, there's going to be some sort of Israeli action, military action against Iran. And so really, over a year, Netanyahu and Trump meet several times. I think Netanyahu comes to the White House like seven times or something like that. And Netanyahu tends, he's a pretty persuasive figure when you sit in front of him. But with Trump, he really had a game plan. And he lays out the case for why Israel wants to take post-12-day war, another military incursion into Iran. And it takes some time, but Trump does eventually get on board with the general idea that Iran does pose a threat. Netanyahu meets with him and quite literally teaches him about how ballistic missiles work, tells Trump why.
What do you mean by that?
I'm told that there's a meeting where Netanyahu and Trump talk about, you know, the extent to which Iran is trying to rebuild its ballistic missile program.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
And how, and really how, like literally how ballistic missiles work. And, the direct threat they pose to Israel and why Netanyahu's so worried about it. But it becomes very clear, maybe not to Trump right away, but definitely to intelligence officials as they're collecting intelligence during this time period, that Iran's ballistic missile program is not, I hate using the word imminent these days because it's become such a story and talking point, but they begin to realize that Iran's ballistic missile program is not developing as fast as the Israelis say it is. It will take years for any kind of intercontinental ballistic missile to reach the homeland, if that is the intent of Iran. Despite some of the caveats that the intelligence community is giving Trump about some of the, you know, threats Netanyahu puts down, Trump does begin to get on board with the fact that, you know, the U.S. military may take military action against Iran.
Let me stop you right there, because two things I want to pick up on. One is, the early talking point for Marco Rubio was that Israel was going to go ahead and launch this attack against Iran, which Israel would say is a preventative defensive attack because they believe they were in danger, but putting that aside, and that the United States intel community had basically concluded that if that attack were to take place, Iran would retaliate not just against Israel, but against the United States. Is that a valid read?
Yeah, to your point, I mean, it was very clear. The intelligence community does assessments all the time. They do them constantly. And so after the 12-day war...
Let's just stop for a second. 12-day war is when we went and bombed their nuclear sites over the course of 12 days.
Correct.
Just so people understand.
Yes. Okay, go ahead. Thank you for explaining that. So over the summer and the fall and into the winter, the running theory and understanding inside both Israel and the U.S. is that Israel is going to take another step to partake in a military operation against Iran to go after its, particularly the remaining missile sites that they did not hit during the 12-day war. And so the intelligence community starts to draw up assessments based on that assumption. And they start to look at outcomes. What happens if Israel goes alone? What happens if we join Israel? And it comes up with all these different assessments. All of them basically lay out the risks. You know, the IRGC is likely to maintain control of Iran should this move forward. If Israel goes in it alone, you know, U.S. diplomatic and military outposts will likely be retaliated against by Iran. The Strait of Hormuz might close, et cetera, et cetera. Despite all of this, though, Trump, throughout sort of like late December and January, as he's continuing to talk to Netanyahu, is increasingly convinced that the long-term threat of Iran is enough to potentially send U.S. military servicemen into Iran for an air campaign. But he doesn't make the decision until the last day and a half, right before the U.S. airstrikes start. I mean, that's classic Trump fashion. He is a decision maker that doesn't like pull the trigger on anything really till the last minute.
Well, let me ask you about that. Let me ask you quickly, because you're talking about all these contingencies and analyses that are happening, which obviously is something that the intel community is going to do. And then the principals take that analysis and they make judgment calls. This administration has said no one could have anticipated that they would have closed the Strait of Hormuz. I think we all sort of recognize that that's kind of bullshit. There's public white papers out there that show that. But more to the point, what do we know about the principals in the administration using that intel and saying, hey, maybe we shouldn't do this, or maybe this is, you know, got some really bad consequences associated with it and it's not worth the upside? Because the other thing we do know, at least according to, you know, Obama and Biden administration officials, that this is not the first time Netanyahu made this case to an American administration, that he had made this case to prior administrations.
I mean, yeah, Netanyahu said publicly he's been trying to do this for 40 years.
Right. So they resisted it because they obviously said that it's too risky a proposition and they don't want to do it, but Trump didn't. Were there principles inside the administration that you know of who are saying, hey, this is maybe not worth it?
I don't know if I know of any one principal that was directly telling President Trump, please don't do this. I mean, I think, you know, that's not the role of the intelligence officials that I cover, but I don't know of that. I don't know of Rubio doing that. I don't know of Kane doing that. I don't know of Hegseth doing that. But the way the Trump administration sort of has worked in the past is that it's very, very rare that you have somebody voicing their opinion in that way, because when people do that, the president does not take kindly to them. But what I will say is that this is why I think we have found ourselves contorted into this messaging campaign where, you know, people are really belaboring the point of, was it an imminent threat? You know, does Iran pose an imminent threat? And to Trump, I don't think it really mattered. Right. Like, I think it mattered for the messaging. I think it mattered for making the case to the American public, which I don't think they've done very well. There's plenty of public, you know, information out there to underscore that. But at the end of the day, I think Trump didn't really care about the word of imminence. And I think
he care about?
Well, I think Bibi made his case, right? He made the case with the ballistic missiles. He made the case that he thought, you know, Iran had the intention of rebuilding its nuclear program. He thought enrichment was a problem. But lastly, and I think most importantly, what comes in at the very end, right before the U.S. strikes, is that the U.S. and Israel gather intelligence about the Supreme Leader's location inside Iran. And Israel was always going to start its military campaign with decapitation strikes, right? Like, what they do is they go in and they take out leaders. And that was always, that's not really a U.S. thing. We don't really do that in the way that Israel does it. But, you know, Bibi says to Trump, look, we have this location of the Supreme Leader. And I think it becomes very personal for Trump. Right. He thinks that, you know, the Supreme Leader tried to kill him. And, you know, let's not forget that this is just a couple of weeks after he launched what is arguably one of the most successful foreign policy operations of his, not just this administration, but prior administration, where he unseats Maduro, captures him, and brings him home. And so both of those things combine, I think, gives him the personal motivation to press the go button.
He's been pretty open about that personal element, too.
I think most things with Trump are personal.
Right. He's referenced it in speeches.
U.S. intelligence believed that Iran was plotting to kill then-candidate Donald Trump. The Secret Service beefed up his security detail. Other precautionary measures were taken. That experience was clearly on his mind as he ordered the attack that killed the Supreme Leader. He told me, I got him before he got me. They tried twice. Well, I got him first.
He talks about how they threatened his life. Mm-hmm. I've always sort of wondered how much that kind of personal anger motivated his decision to do this.
Look, I think if you look at anyone who has ever written anything remotely comprehensive about President Trump, whether it be a book or an article or like a thinky piece, what we all know about Trump is that his decision making is not always grounded in the most reasonable thought process. And a lot of his decision making is based on how he feels personally. I think he said the other day, somebody asked, well, how do you know when the war is done? And he said, I'll just feel it
in his bones.
But I actually think he meant that. Like, you know, like I think people like to think that Trump is more than what he says. But I think what we've learned is that the president and his own spokespeople say this, like the president, when he says something, that's what he means. There might be people messaging around him, but I think what we know about Trump is that, you know, what he says is what he means.
And look, I know when Aaron Benko written pieces fully edited and done when I feel it in my bones. So I get it. You just got to feel for it. Let's fast forward a little bit because I don't think it's crazy to say that things have not gone according to plan, even though the administration will say everything's hunky-dory. Right. What has been the biggest surprise for them, do you think?
For them, and whether or not they should have been surprised, you know, like people can make
different
their arguments.
Yeah.
I think what our reporting has shown, at least, is that they did not expect Tehran to retaliate. They expected the retaliation against Israel and U.S. sort of like installations in the region, but they did not necessarily anticipate the rigor with which Tehran would hit Gulf allies. And I think that's been a big problem. They've had it's a bit of a diplomatic mess. And you have different people saying, well, you know, the UAE wanted it and the Saudis wanted it. But like at the end of the day, what we have now is a regional conflict that has no clear end in sight and has gone a little bit off the rails.
Bulwark Takes is sponsored by Sol. If you've been listening to our show for a while, you already know how much I love Sol's out-of-office THC gummies and their sparkling beverages. Now they've launched something new, mood gummies. Yeah. Lately, I've been more mindful about how I want to feel when socializing, winding down, or just living my life. Instead of defaulting to a drink and hoping for the best, I've chosen Sol's new mood gummies. Whether I need a little spark to go out or something to settle down at night, they've got the perfect option to make me feel just right. Sol is a wellness brand that makes delicious hemp-derived CBD and THC products designed to make you feel good. Sol's new mood gummies have precise dosing, clean ingredients, and formulations designed for predictable effects so you can choose how you want to feel while staying in control. When it's time to wind down, the mellow gummies deliver 3 milligrams of indica THC and CBN. It's ideal for cozy nights and fully unplugging. Make today a good day. Get yourself some Sol gummies. Right now, Sol is offering our audience 30% off your entire order. Yeah, 30%. Go to GetSol.com and use the code BulwarkTakes. That's GetSol.com, promo code BulwarkTakes for 30% off.
The second thing I'll say is that I don't know they fully planned for the closing of the Strait of Hormuz. Maybe they expected it. I mean, this has been something that military planners gamed out for decades. You talk to people who worked in the administration or years ago or career service men who will say that they did this like 10 plus years ago, right? But it's one thing to anticipate it and it's another thing to plan for something. And so there are a lot of questions about the fact that Trump seemingly made this decision to launch the first strikes and on not necessarily a whim, but very last minute. And that there wasn't a lot of planning about the specific timing around the specific timing of that. And one of the things is that they didn't get a coalition together prior to the strikes to say, well, if the Strait of Hormuz closes, will you help us navigate these waters? I mean, diplomats weren't ordered departure until days later, days after the strikes began. But I would say the biggest thing has been they weren't necessarily anticipating that the regime and the IRGC would still be so much intact, and that the retaliation would be long lasting.
Well, it's interesting, and I'm not going to ask you to sort of get into the head of the Iranian leadership here, but I mean, the conventional wisdom is, why would they want to broaden the war, right? Why bring in the Gulf countries by attacking the Gulf countries? Why do that? And I'm guessing that they recognize that it would put pressure on those Gulf countries to put pressure on Donald Trump to stop what's happening here.
Seems like a reasonable tactic. No, I don't know what the Iranians are thinking. I would imagine that they're thinking in line with how any regime would be thinking when they're attacked, which is, how do we maximize damage on the people who are attacking us? I think ultimately we just, you know, Trump said today in the Oval Office with the spray, in the spray in the Oval Office earlier, that, oh, this thing is going to wrap up soon. I mean, maybe, I don't know, or maybe not. And soon, who knows what that means?
They're also requesting $200 billion for it. I mean, that doesn't—
which he said, like, oh, wasn't necessarily just for Iran. So there are a lot of questions about what that funding would actually be for.
Right. Okay. Well, you cover, I know we've had this conversation about the definition of imminence, but yeah. It is a question. So you've been covering, obviously, Tulsi Gabbard, who is the chief intel officer. She was up on the Hill today with the others for the worldwide threat assessment hearings today and yesterday, frankly. Let's just play this exchange she had with John Ossoff, which I thought was kind of interesting. Obviously, the context here that people should know is that Tulsi came into this administration as an avowed pacifist when it came to Middle East wars. I mean, she literally sold t-shirts warning against war with Iran, and made a name for herself politically by talking about forever wars in the Middle East and how horrible they were. And so she's now in this position where she's basically a functionary for Donald Trump as he wages a war in Iran. And her top deputy, Joe Kent, quit spectacularly with a letter that was more or less blaming Israel and Jews for getting Trump into this thing. But he still quit. And now the pressure is kind of on Tulsi to see what she's going to do. And she's been kind of mealy-mouthed about this. She hasn't really said much about how her personal feelings about the war. But she was pressed by John Ossoff about whether there was an actual imminent threat. And here's how it went.
Was it the assessment of the intelligence community that there was a, quote, imminent nuclear threat posed by the Iranian regime, yes or no?
Senator, the only person who can determine and what is and is not an imminent threat is the president.
False. This is the worldwide threats hearing where you present to Congress national intelligence, timely, objective, and independent of political considerations. You've stated today that the intelligence community's assessment is that Iran's nuclear enrichment program was obliterated, and that, quote, there had been no efforts since then to try to rebuild their enrichment capability. Was it the intelligence community's assessment that, nevertheless, despite this obliteration, there was a, quote, imminent nuclear threat posed by the Iranian regime? Yes or no?
It is not the intelligence community's responsibility to determine what is and is not an imminent threat.
Okay.
That is up to the president.
Here's the problem.
Based on a volume
of
information.
No, it is precisely
that he receives.
It is precisely your responsibility.
I don't know. Is she right? That doesn't seem right to me.
I mean, she's splitting hairs. I think the argument that Tulsi's making is the one that, like, intelligence officials, I think, have, you know, rightly made in the right context previously, which is that we are not policymakers. We are supposed to be independent from politics, and we are supposed to be objective. And
no one's asking her about policy preferences here. They're asking about threat assessments.
But I think, like, and I'm not saying this, I'm not saying her argument is sound, but I think what she's trying to do there is parse hairs and say, well, because this, like, imminence word is connected to policy, I'm not going to talk about it. Right. And so, but she did answer questions throughout that hearing and the hearing today, in which she was asked questions about how, you know, how long would it take for Iran? Should it be their intention to build a ballistic missile that would hit the homeland? And she said something about several years. Ratcliffe said similar things. So if you read between the lines, you could see that both on the nuclear program and the ballistic missile program issues, neither of them were imminent threats. But I think people are missing the point. Like, again, I don't think Trump cared about the imminence of the threats. I'm not saying people shouldn't, but I don't think Trump did. And I think why it's important, obviously, is because of international law and the law of war and the ways in which you go about attacking another country. And there are so many legal experts out there that can speak to that better than I can. But what I think people are missing is that, like, okay, so if Trump didn't really care necessarily about, like, the imminent part of the threats, that he just looked at them as national security threats that were growing and potentially long-term threats against the U.S., what he was really focused on then was the regime, about the supreme leader and the people that they took out. But no, but this is important because their messaging has been the Israelis want regime change. That is their thing.
Okay.
Like, we're not after regime change. That is not part of our goal.
Well, let's play that clip, because that's the other clip we have from Tulsi, where she's asked about the objectives of the Israelis in the United States, and she acknowledges that they differ.
My question is, what does the intelligence community assess Israel's goals in this war to be? And are those goals aligned with the goals of the United States?
Long pause.
It's a good question.
I'm thinking carefully here about what can be said in this open setting versus a closed setting.
Are the goals aligned?
The objectives that have been laid out by the president are different from the objectives that have been laid out by the Israeli government.
And how do they differ?
We can see through the operations that the Israeli government has been focused on disabling the Iranian leadership and taking out several members, obviously beginning with the Ayatollah, the supreme leader. And they continue to focus on that effort.
And how does that differ from our goals?
The president has stated that his objectives are to destroy Iran's ballistic missile launching capability, their ballistic missile production capability, and their Navy, the IRGC Navy and mine laying capability.
So why is that significant?
The public messaging on it is different. She's stating what is publicly out there. But I guess what I would, just to back up for a second, what I'm saying is, like, let's put aside the imminent conversation. Like, there wasn't an imminent threat. Ratcliffe basically confirmed that. Tulsi basically confirmed that. All the evidence of reporting out there says that. So, like, take that off the table. So if there wasn't an imminent threat, then what are we doing? And so what we know about those final days right before Trump says go is that they get new intelligence about the supreme leader. And this becomes, like, the focal point for the days leading up to that campaign. And so Trump, you know, based on our reporting, goes and starts this war because he can be part of an operation that takes out.
Yes, but there's a contradiction here, because here we have Tulsi saying that the Israelis publicly want regime change and we publicly want to get rid of ballistic missiles and a threat that could exist.
Yeah,
and
your reporting is saying, it's a contradiction that we should probably talk about.
And your reporting is saying that Trump had an opportunity to do regime change, and whether out of personal pique or just fascination with the idea, he did it. And so, and also, of course, they've been talking.
Or was he just killing a guy that was trying to kill him? Like, whether or not it led to regime change was, like, another thing, right? He knew from his intelligence assessments that should we kill any of these top guys, regime change is not likely to happen. So,
yes, that's true. Okay,
I think they go into this pretty bright eyed that even the Israelis now have come out and said regime change isn't necessarily on, you know, in the short term going
to
happen.
Okay, well, that gets me to my final question, which is, we're here now. It's a mess. I mean, I don't think anyone, well, I guess Pete Hegseth would say it's a smashing success, but it's a mess. The options are not particularly good, it doesn't appear. I mean, you could, I suppose, just say, hey, we did what we needed to do and back out, but we'd still need to open the Strait of Hormuz somehow. What are the off ramps here? Are there off ramps?
I think there have been off ramps previously. I think every Friday there's, like, an off ramp. Right? Because the markets close and you can take the weekend to say mission accomplished and pull out, and markets reopen on Monday and maybe the markets stabilize. I mean, it's all of this is really now a question of, I mean, at least in the US, like, what happens to gas prices? How does this affect us politically for the midterms? And how do we pull out of this thing looking like we've done enough and mission accomplished without sort of passing this threshold of no return on the market end of things? And so much of this is about the Strait of Hormuz, to your point. And I just don't know of any good option for dealing with the Strait of Hormuz beyond pulling out of Iran.
Well, the other option is putting American troops onto the Strait.
Okay, so this gets us to the troop
Kyrgyz Island. No, they're horrible options. I mean, you end up endangering U.S. troops. It's a huge investment. You could see the Iranians abduct a U.S. troop, kill a U.S. troop. You could, you know, I mean, there's a whole host of horrible outcomes that are associated with that.
Yeah. And so now, I mean, there are a couple of things that he could do. He could send troops in to try to, you know, deal with the Strait, to the shores of the Strait of Hormuz. He could send people onto Karg Island, which is the island with basically like Iran's beating energy heart, which he has just over the last week bombed. He could, you know, put troops there to control that island, which I think Besant said today publicly, like, should Karg Island become a U.S. asset, which had everyone confused, like, what do you mean occupying Karg Island? What do you mean becoming a U.S. asset? That's a huge question mark. And then the third option is, you know, he could, as news reports have stated, send troops in to do nuclear containment work to get the nuclear material out of Iran, which is like one of the riskiest operations anybody has ever, which also the Americans and the Israelis have gamed out and practiced and been educated on for years and years and years. Like, those three things are really, I think, arguably not great options, because you're putting American lives on the line for solutions that aren't, or success that is not clearly defined or gettable.
Wow. Thank you for this uplifting conversation. I appreciate it. We're going to keep tabs on this, obviously. We're recording, as you said, Friday presents an opportunity for an off-ramp. We're recording this on Thursday afternoon. I think it's going to be posted on Thursday evening. So we'll see. I mean, honestly, I think you're right about one thing, which is with Trump, it's the markets that really dictate a lot. I mean, we see it time and again that he gets spooked by those things. So we'll see if that happens here. But
yeah, markets and gas prices at the pump. Those are his two, have always been, if you look back over years and years, have always been what he has talked about most publicly and really latched onto when it comes to foreign policy.
All right. We'll keep monitoring it. Aaron Benko, thank you so much for doing this. Appreciate it. We'll have you back more regularly, I promise, because you're very insightful and your reporting is really good.
Thanks.
You guys should check her out at Reuters, and you should subscribe to The Bulwark, because we have good conversations with people just like Aaron. Aaron, thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
Thanks.